Welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. Our guest today is Darren Anderson. Darren Anderson is the author of Inventory, published in 2020, and Imaginary Cities, which was described by The Guardian as a dizzying and brilliant piece of creative nonfiction. He has co-edited the Honest Ulsterman 3am magazine, amongst others, and his work has appeared in The Atlantic and Freeze, amongst others. Welcome, Darren.
Thanks, Nicole.
The story you've chose today is a Mary O'Donoghue story. Am I right? I actually hadn't read it before you picked it.
Yeah, it's called During the Russian Blizzard, and it's in the Stinging Fly Stories collection. It came out a few years ago.
Yeah, it's brilliant. So good.
It's fantastic, yeah. I guess we can unpack it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to read an extract just from, I guess, from the beginning.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So it's called During the Russian Blizzard by Mary O'Donoghue. The English Shedian was a man with skills that flicked out like a Swiss knife. That was my aunt's valediction when he finished covering her guest bedroom ceiling and tiling the rinky-dink ensuite. She wasn't sure if it was English Shedian or English Shetty, she said, and she'd hate to be as ignorant as her colleague who referred to Pakistanians and Iranis. Then he fixed a few other things, free gratis, he insisted. Shaky drawer handles and gutters throttled by leaves. He even locked a boy or two. They were elbowing menacingly onto the back roof, and in a storm would crush the kitchen, he assured her. I'd seen that kitchen in photos. It was a furlong of chrome and white shutters. She told him she couldn't let go, such a capable man. She researched and found the term to be English. She offered to rent him that guest bedroom. It was all above board, she told me, when I turned up in Boston that September. It was all entirely above board. I was at the kitchen island drinking her tea. My face was a blind oblong in the fridge door. After graduation, I'd expected to get a big bite out of life, but nothing big wanted me. Everyone I knew had hied to Australia. I did the books for a 10-seater Terawa bistro in Dublin. Its potatoes came from Kildare, and somewhere in Mayo there was a pig. It was always about to fold. I went out with a head chef, half slept a night in the tussocks of his old futon, and decided to take the hoary year out. I bought it for Boston and my aunt's guarantee. 2 months fact-finding would get me a job. Besides, she said, there was nowhere better than New England in the fall. We drank from porcelain mugs, and she made me take a second French pastry. The Englishman was somewhere in the long garden that fell down to the sea. My aunt was a radiographer who put her learning and time into work, developing and rising until her nose touched the surface. And she was chief radiologic technologist at a hospital where she'd screened, she estimated, some thousands of breasts. One Christmas, three Benedictines, and she told me and my sister, big or small, they all looked like sliced meat on a photo plate. Carpaccio, she said quietly. Then a second time, more slowly. Surprised at her description. We looked down and folded our arms, Charlie. She was my father's sister. She had bouts of imperiousness and grand generosity. Our guests arrived during lean college terms. There was repeated advice to never travel the world with boyfriends. We used to feel sure she'd rescue us into a brighter life someday. I suspected she looked in the mirror some days and turned away in disappointment. His name was Ruslan, and he was proud of it, he told me first thing, because it was the name of the best and most peacekeeping president of his country. He met me at the airport, a dell from Aer Lingus held across his chest. Shaping up for 40, he was square-faced and smooth-haired as a pantanad. He smelled of pleasant herbs like sage and lavender. You knew he would do things well and carefully. He cursed once in the snarled airport traffic. He said, sorry. I said it was a thing of nothing. He laughed at that, a thing of nothing. I had a happy presentiment. He'd started using it and keep using it until it came to annoy me. We picked up speed on the road to the South Shore. I'd been this way once before, 2 weeks in Cape Cod with a crowd from college, but I bypassed my aunt's locale. And I was curious and patient even. See the road and the house and the rooms where she always seemed so content. Something rattled under the Honda's ribs. Ruslan said he was deliberately choosing to ignore it. I flick through the CDs, AC/DC, Bruce Hornsby and the Range, Enya. In an effort to resurrect the banter lost somewhere along Pilgrim's Highway, I said AC/DC were due for a comeback. He said they never left, so they were not due for a comeback. He said I was probably too young to have followed their arc. I asked him if Enya had been big in Ingushetia. He took the CD and he looked at it a long while. He probably took the same serious slant to every topic. He probably measured everything with a set square. His left hand on the wheel was steady and relaxed, garbed in velvet. Keeping like Bambi, Enya was now in his crosshairs. It made me wonder if he'd been a sniper at some stage. He had the look of a militia, dark flak zipped under his chin. I couldn't remember if Ingushetia was a wary hotspot. I was suddenly disgusted by how little I knew or cared about world politics. Ruslan would surely be conversant in every Irish pitched battle and field rising. He left Enya aside and said he was glad in the cockles of his heart that such an angel had never made it to his country. He called it a toilet and a cauldron. He pointed out new shingles loosened in a church cupola, trees taken down here and there, all by last week's high wind. He never stopped smiling, right the way to turning up a steep driveway, a house on a hill, my aunt waving us on with a straw hat. In the first week, I drank lots of flavours of tea, hibiscus, darjeeling, the green leaves my aunt steeped with a virtuous grimace. I put in time on her slim silver laptop, job searches, dating sites. My sister said I should post a profile as soon as I fetched up in Boston. It's what people did, she said, when they moved somewhere new. Hung up their clothes, sorted their money, and gave themselves a nickname, some outdoor pursuits, and the best smile amongst all their photos. No convert like my zealous sister, who married her fiancé across a speeding date table in Ringsend. I perused profiles. Grinning, tanned, and hopeful, they made me nostalgic for the scruffy Lebanese chef. I replied to an ad for an entry-level accounts receivable analyst. I got told I was too qualified. I answered an ad for a bookkeeper. Growing firms wanted comptrollers, the ad said. A Cambridge startup called me for an interview. Hour in the line ended in a vague tip-off about another startup that might be willing to orchestrate the visa they said I'd need, but it was a long shot because nobody wanted to pay for a visa in a tight economy. I took a phone interview for a weekend job. Tutor wanted, college student. Accounting was his nemesis, he said, but he needed it to become an entrepreneur. He had big plans, he said. He saw opportunity everywhere. He agreed to start the following week, 3 hours on Saturdays, 2 on Sundays if they were needed for impending exams. His mother telephoned to cancel. He was concerned my Irish training wouldn't transfer. No hard feelings, she assured me. None, I said. I postponed the job search and committed myself to self-improvement. I researched Ingushetia. I studied its history of upheaval. It rose against Russia, against communists, against Northern Ossetia. And lately, there had been trouble biting around the border with Chechnya. Suicide bombings, high-profile murders, and kidnappings. Years ago, they had a beautiful female sniper who had never been captured. Everything from its ancient three-handled pots to all the boxers and wrestlers it claimed as famous people made me sad not to have known Ingushetia sooner. An elderly woman sat with me in the small library. Together, we took book after book for interlibrary loan. A lot of them had Ingushetia nested in studies of Russia and Chechnya. Many titles were in the English language, parades of vowels umbrellaed by long accent marks. I settled on an English book about counterinsurgency, disappeared persons and human rights. The librarian said it would take 10 days. She ran after me with another reference, a John le Carré spy thriller containing an English renegade, and the library had it. I went home with the paperback. A man's silhouette stood in a door looking out on rocky encampments. The sky was crimson, melting to pink. It looked pulpy and compelling. Fixed on the climate is a question for Ruslan. He reported it as summer beauty, sometimes brutal in winter. His father used to say, and he pardoned himself for relaying it, the person put their balls in a lunchbox in the freezer, or they let January take them. I was sitting on the back deck, watching a wasp disco round his arm. He was putting a new handrail on the steps in the deck. My aunt was in the rose bushes. Below the rose bushes, the sea slurred and intimated. It was evening, the last Saturday in October. A dead blue hammer, Ruslan had told me proudly, filled with lead shot. It struck hard and heavy, but didn't mar the surface surrounding the nail. A beautiful idea, he said.
Thanks, Darren. That was a lovely reading.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's maybe just talk about why you chose this story and, yeah, why this particular story out of all the choices on the Stinging Fly website.
So it's a bit of a strange one. I think I encountered Mary O'Donoghue years ago as a poet.
Yeah.
There was a time where I was involved in editing poetry publications and websites and things, and there were other times where I guess poetry was all I could really handle.
Mm-hmm.
There'd be times in your life where, you know, the sky's falling in and you can only handle a little short passage of writing. It tends to be super intense. Or what poetry does for me, I think, is it slows time down, so you get a little sort of sanctuary when the rest of your life is sort of, you know, almost like an avalanche. You sort of, the poem is a little like snow cave in the midst of an avalanche when everything else is falling apart. So I'm pretty sure I encountered her work as a poet years ago, and I didn't really put the two names together that it was the same person. There was a particular poem that I remember of hers called The 80s.
Mm.
And I think you can find it online. I think it's on Poetry International's website. And I highly recommend it. It's great. It's written sort of like fragments of a childhood in the 80s. And it's very true to the 80s. I see a lot of kind of nostalgic shows, you know, like Stranger Things and stuff. And they always have the 80s as this kind of like, everything's a bit too clean and neon and sort of fantastic.
It's like the Spielberg version of the
Yeah, where Sadie's were like, I just have the color brown in my head and really garish orange wallpaper and checkpoints, and it was really, really grim. In an interesting way, you know, everything was sort of the wrong color of paisley, and I felt like her poem really captured that in a way that I hadn't encountered before. So I had this kind of deja vu when I chanced upon, my partner recommended it actually. And she has this, she's always trying to drag me back into the modern world because I have a tendency to drift away and I want to go become, live in a pillar out in the wilderness. And she's always saying, you know, you should really try. And I mean, you're not very good at being a contemporary writer when you're reading, you know, 17th century dictionaries and stuff. And so she's always kind of pulling me back in, like trying to lasso me back into the modern world. God help her. And
you won't like it there.
No, it's a horrible place. But it's eventful, at least.
Yeah.
And it passes the time. But she recommended it. And initially, I have to be honest, like one of the reasons I really liked this story was because as I get older, I've realized that the things, well, I'm kind of fed up with the things I like.
Mm.
I'm sort of tired of them. You know, I'm mistrustful of my own taste.
Mm.
And whenever I get a sort of feeling of resistance, now, like I hear a song and it really grates on me, I think, oh, this is interesting. And very often that becomes a song that I end up loving. There's something in it that's quite disruptive initially, and I've learned now to go with that and be open to that, because that's usually where the best stuff comes from. If I'm impressed by something straight away, that's usually a bad sign.
Yeah, I understand. I definitely understand what you mean. Or there's something like immediately impressive about something that you, if it's too impressive, you should be suspicious of it. But in a previous email, you mentioned that you didn't, you you don't often read a lot of realism, like a lot of realistic maybe fiction that you would tend to read.
Yeah, that's true. So my sort of sweet spot, I guess, is sort of semi-fantastical writing. Mm. And I think it was because growing up in Derry, it's a very working class place, the troubles were happening. You wanted to escape, really. It was imperative to escape. So I gravitated towards very escapist literature. And I still have that leaning. You know, I love reading Borges and Calvino and Alipo, and I love reading Bruno Schultz and Samuel Delaney and people like that are weird sci-fi people, weird magic realists, very dark magic realist stuff. And I like it sort of exploring the globe. And I think it's a form of escapism from childhood that's lasted. But I started wondering about it recently, and especially reading this story. I think the reason I resisted realism was because it just never seemed very real to me.
Yeah.
It wasn't recognizable. You would hear all these accounts, and you know, people would recommend certain books. They'd say, oh, you have to read this really hard-boiled minimalist prose short story writer, and it's really edgy and it's transgressive and stuff. And I just wouldn't recognize the world that I'd grown up in or the world I inhabit now. So I guess the problem was that the realism didn't feel real. It felt more of a contrivance than the fantastical, in a way. Yeah, with a story like this, it absolutely feels real. It feels like people I know. It feels like me in some way. And I think my resistance initially to the story was because Mary O'Donoghue, being a poet, she has a tendency to luxuriate in language.
Mm.
And initially that brought me out of the story. It was almost like it had an alienation effect. It kept bringing me, you know, she'd have these amazing words and amazing sentences.
Mm-hmm.
And they initially seemed too poetic. But I pushed beyond that and I realized, no, that's actually what I kind of love that.
Mm-hmm.
My initial resistance was a kind of attraction, I guess. I love etymology. I love poets that luxuriate. I love, you know, Manley Hopkins and Heaney and people who really, you can taste the words, you know, they're so rich, and all the words contain mysteries and they carry their own sort of secrets. And so when I initially read it, when my partner Jill gave me the story, I was very, very sort of reticent about it. And then I read it like 3 or 4 times and I loved it every time more. I was just like, I love her use of language.
Yeah, yeah.
I love the ambiguity of it.
Yeah, I love the ambiguity of it as well. And it's very subtle as well as having like quite lush language.
Yeah, she has an incredible pacing. Like it's almost hypnotic the way she paces it. And there's this sense of, you know, it leans very much on the iceberg effect. The iceberg effect is present in this story. There's lots of unexplained histories, and you're given little clues that, you know, the person might have be carrying this secret.
Mm.
It might be this person from the past, or it could be something else, but you feel like the reader is allowed to wander.
Yes. Yeah.
I think O'Donoghue's like, she's confident enough to leave space for the reader to do that. And I think a lot of contemporary writers, for me, they see a space, they want to fill it up.
Yeah.
They want to tell you stuff. And it's just like, no, this is a story that's allowed to breathe. And it's kind of magical. And
yeah.
I mean, it's not magical at all in terms of the subject matter. It's about, you know, sex and war and secrets and. But I was totally hypnotized by it, I have to say. Mm.
I do feel like that the kind of strength of the story is she's not directing your attention in one kind of way. She is letting you kind of decide certain things yourself as the reader, in like a sort of, in a very like graceful and subtle way.
Absolutely. And it speaks of a very confident writer to be able to do that. I a lot of my touchstones are sort of outside of writing.
Mm.
And occasionally, I think because of the anxiety of influence, I don't want to read anyone really that's writing at the moment too closely, because I'm afraid I do have a tendency to mimic things.
Yeah.
So I get a lot of stuff from films and music. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that when you listen to things like classical music or ambient music or drone or whatever, folk music even, the really confident artists, they allow space to exist. They allow, you know, they use silence like almost like a sculpting kind of device.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Mary O'Donoghue utilizes that beautifully in this, very, very powerfully in this story. You know, it's quite an edgy story. She allows these undercurrents. You know they're there. You're not quite sure the shape of them. You can feel the pull. And
I totally agree. And also, she doesn't use that very annoying kind of thing where she has like the explainer sentence. You know, she has like three or four explainer sentences. I feel like that's something I come across in a lot of contemporary fiction, where there should be one sentence and you should let a little bit of mystery. There's three or four sentences after it. She doesn't do that at all.
There's very little exposition dumps, and it's more. It's more affecting because of that. It really gets under your skin. You know, if we had a sort of, you know, a paragraph about post-Soviet politics or gender conflict, it would just diffuse that. It would take the sort of magic, the sort of dark magic I feel that this story has. It would totally mitigate that. And instead she allows that it's almost there's a kind of music to what she's doing. And I think one of the problems we have these days, not to be like man shouts a cloud, but
it's fine.
There is a kind of tyranny of certainty, I find, in the discourse and in culture. There's a kind of oppressive quality of certainty. Everybody just seems really certain about extremely uncertain things, you know, where things are contradictory and they're in flux all the time, but everyone's, you know, all back their takes and the takes are automatic. And I just think there's an incredible power in uncertainty and just, you know, accepting that and admitting that you know, we don't know.
Exactly. But I think people also get very angry now when they encounter something that isn't certain or that makes them question stuff. It makes them a little angrier. Like I saw Tar, the film, which I thought was like a great character study, and then you come out and there's like people are so angry about it because there is so much kind of ambiguity in that film, and there's like 100 articles written, and it's people are like, I have to lock down what this means. And it's like, well, do you really though? Can you not just sit with it and be like, this was what it was, you know?
Absolutely. I saw a film too, and it's amazing that they can't even sit with silence. They have to have an answer. And I mean maybe I'm a cynic, but I feel like there's a false comfort to that. There's a false comfort to having explanations.
I agree.
There's a maturity comes, maybe it's just that you give up, you're disillusioned or de-romanticized or post-lapsarian, maybe a good word for it. But you no longer, you can accept ambiguity, you can accept contradiction, and you realize that that's actually the dynamo of art, that the best stuff, the stuff that really gets in your skin, that really changes you, has this exploratory sense. You know, it's not telling you anything, it's just showing you the world, it's reflecting something.
Or showing you a person very close up, you know, like really trying to understand them. I actually wrote down the exact same word in reference to the story, which is like grown up. I feel like this is a very grown up chore story. Even in the handling of sex and things, like I feel like it's got an air of
And the unsolved nature, like, you know, there's a spoiler alert, but there's a sort of sex scene at the end, and everything is sort of hinted at, and it's all glances and sort of fragments and. Mm. It's really, really powerful because there isn't an answer given for any of it.
Yeah.
There's no big reveal. There's no sort of twist.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that, like, we've had a regression in recent years. You know, like, I watch, occasionally I'll go to the Bay of Fire somewhere and I'll watch, like, you know, Casablanca.
Yeah.
Or The Wizard of Oz, or, you know, whatever, a film from like the 30s or 40s. And I realized that like they're incredibly sophisticated films.
Yeah.
You know, they are not tropes. You know, the femme fatale characters are always really complicated. And they're much more kind of weirdly empowered and have more agency than the characters I see now who are just walking, talking ciphers for someone's, you know, belief system give people reassurance. I'm like, I'm of the Camus school where it's like, you know, humans are trying to cling on to things that probably don't exist.
Yeah. I don't know who wants reassurance. Like, I'm like, if that's what you're going to, you know, to the cinema for, to books for, that is not what you should be looking for.
And this terrible pious mantra that I hear all the time now, empathy, you know, as if, you know, literature needs justified in some way. It's, oh yeah, we're all sort of engineers of empathy. And I'm like, I don't want to hear that word ever again. Sorry, but like, you know, take it for granted that we're talking about, you know, we're inventing monologues in other people's heads and stuff. It is an empathetic act, but I hate this piety of very preachy. No, I didn't escape the Catholic Church and get to sign up for this stuff. You know, this and the priests and the dogmas. And it's like, no, some of us got out of that 20 years ago and I don't want to go back.
Yeah.
You know, regardless of how noble it seems, I just don't feel it represents reality. You know, it's like some of the best things are disturb and push you into an uncomfortable place, and you learn who you are. You know, life teaches you who you are, often through hardships and suffering. Now, I definitely have felt that the last few years. Be very rough and turbulent for a lot of people. But I absolutely know who I am now. You know, it's like, I wish I didn't, in a way. You know,
do you think that, like, the turbulence of kind of now and the last few years has resulted in people being like, I want something safer? It's like, I keep seeing it. I actually think someone wrote about it recently, but the word relatable, everything's like, it's so relatable. That book is so relatable. I was like, relatable to me? How? I don't want to, I'm pretty one of a kind. I doubt it's relatable to me, you know?
No, it's like, why is that even a positive
thing?
Relatable. Like, I don't want to read about working in dead-end jobs and you know, like, I want to be pushed somewhere that if it's going to be something, you know, egocentric, then I want something I didn't know about myself. Like, you want to know, like, is there a wolf in there, you know? Like,
good, absolutely. You don't know what you're capable of in that kind of way.
People are too, I think, like, I have, the older I get, the less certain I am about stuff. And especially, you know, I'm a father now, and I realize how much the big figures in my life, the big monolithic figures, like parents and uncles, and they're all, you know, they're dying now, and I'm burying them. And I realized that they weren't monolithic at all. They were making it up as they were going along.
Yeah.
And they were doing a great job in terrible circumstances. But there's been no great reveal of, you know, I say this to friends sometimes. It's like, there's a school of literature where it's like, you know, the darkness of suburbia, you know, sort of revolutionary road, this idea of like, oh, life is so boring in suburbia, and, you know, how do we escape it? And, you know, all these undercurrents underneath it. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, I would love you to live in suburbia.
They're like, back then they were like, I hate my beautiful house and my steady job and my income. I'm too happy. And now we're like,
happy? Yeah, please let me own a house.
Yeah.
It's so weird, but I guess you just, humans have an innate capacity to resist, and they'll resist even happiness, even security. And I guess I'm doing it now. I'm resisting whatever the, you know, I was belligerent when it was priests telling me things, and I'm belligerent now, and I'll be belligerent when it changes again. It's just, some of us are like that, and hopefully some good things are created along the way. But if you're looking for answers in literature, you know, you're looking in the wrong place. Go to politics or go to, you know, whatever studies. It's like the best art, the best literature, the best culture, in my opinion, are things that just create more and more questions. Yeah. They're not things that create answers. If I wanted an answer, I'd, you know, I'd read the Quran or I'd read the Bible or I'd read the Communist Manifesto. It's like I don't come to fiction for that. And I think Mary O'Donoghue's a brilliant example of a writer where you're left with more questions at the end than you had at the beginning.
Yeah, I feel like that is also, that is the way I judge things. Like, as soon as I read something, I don't judge it on a level of like, oh, I related so much to that, you know, that happened to me. How much I want to talk about it, regardless of whether or not I liked it, like films or books. It's like, I want to talk about this with someone. That means it was interesting, you know? Yeah.
And that's all you need. And I don't know where the sort of sureness, I don't know where that comes from. Like, I don't trust my own opinion enough to be certain about it. Like, I'm quite an untrustworthy person, even to myself.
Yeah.
I don't want to be sure about anything, because I know from my own experience, if I'm honest, I know, you know, places I've gone and things I've done and the people I've been. That's the last thing I want is a recommendation from me.
But one thing I really loved about this story, and I think it's exactly what you're saying, is like how uncontrived it seems. None of the conversations feel like shoehorned in, or everything that happens like happens very naturally. And when it happens, you're like, of course, then that is what would have happened, you know?
Exactly. And yeah, you notice even in the little passage where they're talking about Enya, and I have a lot of time for Enya, as every person does.
Very nice.
Yeah, she's ethereal, magical sort of goddess lady. Yeah. But, you know, you read these stories and friends of mine will say, oh, well, there's this amazing story in the New Yorker and there's lots of good stuff there. But the writer wants to be almost too cool for school and, you know, they're dropping in all the right references and stuff. And that immediately is turn off to me. I want to know like the granular level of life. I guess it's something, becoming a father is plays a part in this, because you're no longer cool. Like, my kid doesn't care if I tell him, you know, that I love talking heads, or I, you know, your dad's super cool and has had all these adventures around the world. He just thinks I'm just this corny, lame guy. And that's the way life is. There's a sort of generational redundancy that happens. Mm-hmm. But I think great art can come from staring at that. I really feel like there's a sense of arrested development. You know, I don't want to be young. I feel sorry for some, you know, young people that I work with. It's incredibly intense compared to the way it was when we were young. There was no mobile phones. There was no internet. You know, if you were bullied at school, you went home and you had a sanctuary away from it. Now there's no escape.
Yeah.
Everything's so visible and visual. There's a sense of, I love, you know, an artist like Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, the way they're just getting better the more albums they bring out. It reminds me of, like, there's a Japanese woodblock artist, it's either Hiroshige or Hokusai, but they said, you know, I'm 70 years old now and my work's finally starting to get okay. When I'm 80, it's going to be great. And when I'm 90, you know, I finally have arrived.
Yeah. I think there is an obsession, like primarily, I think, in publishing with on youth, you know, like I feel like it's always I can't say with any, you know, exactly, but I do feel that like maybe young writers aren't getting the same chance to grow as they would have maybe 30 years ago and things. It is always like the new thing in a way that I don't see reflected in like film, where it's like, oh, this director's on their fourth or fifth film. Now they're getting there.
Absolutely. Other than, yeah.
in books.
There's a cult of youth, and it definitely can be quite destructive and certainly constraining for writers.
Yeah.
I never had that problem. I only really started to get things published when I was about 35.
Mm.
And I'd been writing since I was like 16.
Yeah.
So it was a long, long time. And I probably needed some of that time. I didn't need all of that time. I probably could have been published in the 20s and still been there. You know, like the books I have that haven't come out are, you know, probably the equal of the books that have come out. But I think for female writers, certainly there's a terrible, I think, burden placed. This, you're the young ingenue who's brought out this sassy, edgy kind of book, and incredible amount of pressure. And I don't see publishers having the duty of care that they might have, or yeah, the sense of developing an artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a Kate Bush obsessive, and mm-hmm, I was reading about how she made a tape. She was like writing music since she was like 12 or something, and she made this demo tape, and it had like dozens of songs on it, and it somehow got to Dave Gilmour of Pink Floyd, and they kind of waited for her.
Mm-hmm.
They reached like 19 or 20 before they released it, because they just knew she wasn't going to be ready,
yeah,
for what was going to come her way.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you probably wouldn't get that now. You wouldn't get that level of restraint.
No, because the marketing around it would be like, she's 15, she's 16. No,
absolutely. And she would end up, you know, probably bringing out one album or two albums, because the pressure would be too much, you know. So I think, yeah, the arrested development that you see in a lot of culture these days, and probably always has existed, that we always had a cult of youth. You know, I wrote a long piece recently on Marcus Aurelius and research in the Roman Empire and ancient Greece. You realize that like not a lot has actually changed morally. Technology has changed and medicine has changed, but like they were saying the same things we say.
Mm.
They were thinking the same things we think.
Mm.
And maybe that's always the case. We're in this sort of cycle.
Yeah.
But I wish, like, whenever I hear of a writer come out, really exciting writer, everyone, there's a big buzz and they're trending on Twitter and everything. I want to know what their second book is, what their third book is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want to know what the fashion is, what the fad is of the time. It's like, where do these people go next?
Mm.
Because that's often the most interesting stuff.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, like I was saying there about things being considered relatable, and, you know, if they get kind of pushed into that box of this is the sort of thing you have to write without ever feeling comfortable there, if that's not what they want to write, then it can be very difficult to find your voice. So, you know, it feels like something imposed on you rather than something that's kind of arisen naturally.
Absolutely. There's always, it's like the thing that Joyce said, you know, when your soul takes flight, there's people with nets trying to catch it and put it in the box, you know, people like religion and nationalism and identity. And that's inevitably going to happen to some extent, because we're finite creatures. So someone's going to say, oh, well, this is a man's book, or this is an Irish book. And I think we have there's an imperative to really claim as much space for yourself as possible.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons why I reached out, when I wrote Imaginary Cities, I bounced off Italo Calvino for that. And then when I wrote Inventory, I bounced off George Perec.
Mm.
The reason I did was because I knew in both cases I'd be the Irish writer, which I am.
Mm.
But they would, you know, the analogies that would be made would be, you know, Angela's Ashes or whatever. And it's like, no, you have to really expand.
Mm.
We're going to be put in a box. It helps if you can make that box as big as possible and contain as many things as possible.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I wanted to bring in writers from places that I'm totally foreign cultures, and show that, you know, we're there's a kind of archipelago of us, and strange connections made, and that's really, really interesting. I've had a definite reluctance to be herded or corralled. But I mean, it's inevitable because they have, you know, critics have to talk about something. I understand that.
They have to talk about something boring, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, they could expand it a little bit more. And I just see, you know, I love Irish writing. I love the Renaissance in Irish writing. If, you know, if it ever had dimmed, which I don't think it has, I think it's been great for 100 years, if not more.
Yeah.
But, and there's writers who I have incredible affinity with personally, and I love their work. But, you know, we're so different too. I compare it to like herd and cats. It's mm-hmm. sort of like we are all, I love the fact that everybody's doing their own thing.
Yeah, exactly. Every like Irish writer, I feel like it is sort of an injustice when you feel them all lumped together, because I've read many of these books and I don't even feel like, you know, they're influenced by lots and lots of different things. You can tell that, you know, and I feel when everyone's put in like one big thing, it's not exactly right or fair, you know.
No, and it's a very globalized culture that we have, and technology driven culture, and you know, we're not living in the Ireland of 50 years ago. So, but I love the idea that there's people out there all scattered around.
I had a question for you at the end, Darren, which I'm just going to ask now, since we're in that direction. But I was thinking, because of your memoir, Inventory, which is about growing up during the Troubles. I unfortunately haven't read it, but if you'd like to talk about it for a minute or two, and then I have a question.
Sure. Yeah, so it's, I think I wrote it. It's hard to know why I wrote it, but I think retrospectively, having a kid who, you know, his mum was born in Australia, a kid was born in Scotland, he's grown up in London, he doesn't have a connection. He has connection by blood to Ireland, but he doesn't really know that world at all. And I think I wanted to write just to let him know when he's older who his people were from his father's lineage, and I think his mom's doing the same in her writing from her direction, and yeah, just to give him some grounding, some kind of sense of his roots. But I also realize when I wrote that book, so it's a memoir about growing up in Derry and sort of poverty and conflict and division and everything, but also just the resistance to that. Like, you were always trying to have the crack. You were always up to badness and exploring things. And it was, you know, just the innate deviancy of kids. You're always trying to find a space that's sort of autonomous and getting up to all sorts of trouble. I realized in hindsight, my dad, I don't know. It's hard to speculate, but my dad wasn't really cool with the book coming out. I guess he knew the story more than I ever could. And so he was a kind of, my dad was like a hippie pacifist sort of guy. And he was a bodybuilder. He had long hair. He looked sort of like Billy Connolly, only like huge muscles and tattoos. And he's a real eccentric and a wonderful man, but very peaceful. You know, he's a pacifist, really, but a strong, you know, he spoke softly and carried a big stick. And then I found out later in life that he'd been in the IRA as a teenager, and he'd been in H blocks and had a terribly brutalized childhood because of the way Catholics, especially working class Catholics, were treated during the Troubles and before the Troubles. And I guess he couldn't get his head around what I was doing with the book or what I was trying to do. And then unfortunately we were stuck here in London because of lockdown and COVID and everything. And he caught COVID and very unexpectedly died from it. And, you know, he's in ICU for 6 months. We couldn't talk to him because he had a tracheostomy. So we never got, and we found out, you know, he was functionally illiterate. So he couldn't write down anything or spell anything. He had no voice for 6 months. So we never really found out what he was saying or thinking. But it was a terribly brutal time. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. It was horrendous. But I was lucky enough to get back the last 4 nights of his life. I did the night shift. My mom did the day shift. And I was able to be just me and him, you know, looking after him at night time. And it was a blessing, and it was really, really hard. It was the hardest nights of my life. I didn't sleep for 5 days. I was hallucinating by the end of it. It was like a bad trip. But I'm glad now, in hindsight, that it happened. And I feel that the book has changed retrospectively. I think the book was it's certainly now a tribute to my dad. But maybe it was always a tribute. He didn't really speak to me for about a year. I mean, there was no official falling out, but he was just very, very quiet for a year before he died. And we didn't really get to reconcile. And, you know, because I wrote the book. But I felt we silently got to reconcile maybe at the end. It's hard to say, but certainly the nature of the book changed. Life changed it. You know, it's the same book, it's the same words, in the same order, but it's not the same book that came out before COVID. It's a very different, more haunted book, but I feel more meaningful book. So yeah, that was a tough one. And that's, you know, everything, it's insignificant ultimately compared to what happened for my family, but the book got washed away, really. It's a very strange experience. I never saw it in the bookshop.
Oh, yeah,
of course. Because they were, you just, like I said before, it was like dropping a stone down a bottomless well and waiting to hear for echoes. And but I realized, like, that's sometimes, I don't know, noble would be too self-important a word, but maybe that's necessary. Maybe there's some subjects that are so difficult that you need a bit of pain digging in certain spots. You need to feel, you know, it can't be easy. Anybody who writes a memoir believes it's easy. Yeah. Is not digging in the right place. Mm. Really not. You know, it's like a trial.
Mm.
Yeah, and in a way that's sort of the things I've been working on since are very, very different. Mm. I'll never be back in that headspace, really. So.
And do you feel now, you know, there's a lot of kind of writing coming up, like post Troubles. Like I had Michael McGee on recently, and his new novel is coming out, Close to Home and Things. And this is sort of the generation that didn't grow up maybe exactly during the Troubles, but their parents definitely did. And there's still this kind of imprint on their lives. And I just find that really interesting.
It's fascinating. And I think it's, you're noticing it. The way Lucy Caldwell writes, Wendy Erskine writes, Lisa McGee writes, hopefully the way I write, there's a breaking of a kind of omerta that existed in the North. And we can do that because we've a degree of space, especially those of us that have moved away. We have a degree of breathing space that our parents simply didn't have. You know, so there's a very, very odd, although there are some great Northern Irish writers who are overlooked, there's a real gap between Heaney's generation, which was my grandfather's generation, and then our generation. There's this sort of black hole. And yeah. We can write about it because we were in the age of it. You know, I was born in 1980. I remember that, you know, I lived next to a checkpoint. I seen violence. I was involved in violence. But it felt theatrical. It didn't feel the way, you know, when I started researching my aunts and uncles' lives and my dad's life, I mean, they were staring into the abyss with this stuff. That they had unbelievably traumatic experiences. And we had the room, we were a transitional sort of liminal generation where we had the space to observe. And the distance where we didn't have to be involved. I often say, you know, there's friends of mine's, a friend of mine's Chris Kelly, who's a film director here. He's from back home. And we'll occasionally talk about how, you know, what would you have done had you been born 15 years earlier? And I know our temperaments, like both of us are hotheads, so I can't see us escaping it. By the grace of God, we did. And we have, I think we're lucky enough to have a viewpoint that our parents weren't allowed. And that's why people are talking, you know, people are, tends to be middle-aged writers as well. We're getting to the age where we're having kids. We're looking back and we're trying to explain our childhoods to ourselves and our sort of the baggage we've been carrying. So it's really interesting. There's a lot of great writers from the North. Yeah.
Some really great, it feels so many as well.
Yeah. It's
all bringing something different, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, we're lucky the generation before us didn't get a chance to do that. It was great risk. I mean, you could get shot for what you wrote. You could definitely get exiled. And I mean, there's a cost now. You know, when I went back to bury my dad, I literally was carrying his coffin and, you know, walked away and they put it. He worked for the council and the council men and women all with their high-vis vests and they did like a gauntlet, you know, they were applauding both sides of us walking out, you know. It was very, very emotionally overwhelming. And the band were playing Bob Dylan's song Forever Young and I had to just walk in the churchyard for a wee while to just kind of, you know, get my shit together again. Just compose myself and someone came up and said, "Sorry, son, you know, can I have a word about your book?" And I was like, "Jesus Christ, I mean, could you wait 10 minutes to bury my dad?" You know, but the stuff is still that contentious.
Yeah.
There's still a risk and you still, you know, I feel weird going back home now because people call me out all the time about what I wrote. And to be honest, I'm like, Jesus, the things I could have wrote, you know, the things I didn't put in the book were explosive.
Did you feel when you were writing it that you were self-monitoring in that way? Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Often the best stories you're told, you have to, like, rebury them. Because it would just have a terrible impact on people's lives. And I know other writers who shall remain nameless would include the stories, but I couldn't do it. I was told absolute, you know, just unreal stories of violence. And you have to weigh up what impact it's going to have in your life and what impact it's going to have in their life.
Mm.
And you can't mess around with other people's trauma. It's okay doing it for yourself if you feel cut out for it, and I do generally. But you have no right. I don't believe, you know, I'm a journalist as well as a writer, and I don't believe that everything's copy. I absolutely don't.
I don't believe that either. No. I hate when that's seen as just that Nora Ephron quote is bandied around like no one's business, and it just isn't true. And it's also just like, here, everything's copy. Here's this story about my boyfriend. Like, I'm like,
it speaks to me of a certain degree of entitlement and privilege. It really is not. It's not someone who is engaged with the consequences of things. Yeah. Things can. I could put things in. I could have put things in inventory that would have blown up people's lives.
Yeah.
That would have caused them. You know, that would have got them arrested. Really. And I couldn't write down a lot of this stuff because of the Boston tapes. You know, I don't want to get pulled in and have to testify against some loyalist or Republican from 40 years ago. You know, but. But you have to tread carefully when you tread in other people's lives. And,
yeah, I agree.
And you have to know yourself if you're caught out to even look at your own life. Because your own life can be, you go to some dark places, like the Nietzsche thing about staring into the bus and the bus staring back, that does happen. Mm-hmm. Not to be overly dramatic, like it's not. We're still writing books. We're not going down a coal mine, but
feels like that some days.
Oh, yeah. But, my granddad was a trawlerman and a minesweeper in the war, and he would be laughing if he heard my.
Oh, yeah. That's the way I talk about it sometimes. Just before we go, I'm going to bring it back to the story because there was one fascinating thing in the story. Now, like I said, like this is what great stories make you want to do, which is talk about them. What did you think of Russin as a character? Did you trust
him? Really? Yeah, really, really fascinating.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I guess yeah. I have a fondness for noir and yeah. unreliable yeah, narrators and grey yeah. area people, and that needs to come back. That would be the antidote to a lot of stuff in the disco today, because there's this look. There aren't straight villains and there aren't straight saints, and you know, villains and saints are equally monstrous to me. You know, there's so many people claiming sainthood these days. It's like we are shit. We don't even know ourselves. Like I don't know what I'm capable of in the wrong circumstance. You know, and I've been in really bad circumstances, and you do not know. I'm not confident about how thin the ice is or how thick the ice is. And I feel like the Rosalyn character, he reminds me of a sort of old school noir.
Yeah.
Like growing up in Northern Ireland, there's certain places around the world, like say, you know, interwar Vienna or Bangkok or Northern Ireland, or Yugoslavia, where the conflict and division is such that people have to be shape-shifting almost.
Mm-hmm.
They have to often perform or have a mask, and their loyalties have to be, you know, we had to watch. Well, you know, there were times I was asked, where am I from? In Northern Ireland, and if I say Derry or Londonderry, that could end in really, really bad consequences. So you have to, there's a degree of subterfuge that you have to have. And that character read so true to me, because those are the defense mechanisms you're forced to have when you grow up in a place that is violent and divided. And he just seems so real. He seems like guys I know. You know, I bumped into, like, on my travels, you know, people in Estonia and Croatia and places that, and Cambodia, that have seriously dark histories and have definitely done, if not done terrible things, then seen terrible things.
Yeah.
And he seems to me like one of those characters.
Yeah, definitely. And it's hard, like, there is that exchange between them when he's reading out about the paper about the boy that tricked this rich family into thinking he was their son. And there's that great line. It's like they must have kind of wanted it, or they must have. And I think that's very true of, like, people being scammed. I think the relationship between the aunt and him is, like, so complex that you could read that story maybe.
Oh, yeah. Times. Yeah. It's like a novel, but there's so many layers. And that, and that character that that's alluded to, it's almost like a kind of Kaiser Soze moment. It's like, is that him? Is it his relative? You know, it's just, but again, she's a genius in the sense of leaving that ambiguous, because you're thirsting for more. You're like, you know, it gives you this appetite. It's a great example of the iceberg effect.
Yeah. Okay. And also it totally subverts the cliche, which is, like, you know, the cliche of, like, you know, the person doing the scam is bad and the person scammed is good, but this, I think, really, really plays with that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the way life is. You know, it's like there's a sort of arrested development or willful naivety, the way people talk. Like, I've lived in crazy places and encountered very traumatized people in different places around the world, and including the place I grew up and my family. And they are not groups, they're not ciphers for ideologies and wish fulfillments. They are extremely difficult people, often, who have their own desires and fears and wants and secrets and duplicities. And O'Donoghue has a great grasp of that, absolutely encapsulates it in that character. You know, I see it a lot in Britain. People will pick quite a essentialist sort of political view or tribalist political view, and then, you know, everything is good that they espouse and everything that's the opposite is bad. And it's just like, look, life simply does not, if you've escaped a place that has had hardship, you're going to be carrying a lot of stuff, good and bad. You're not a saint, you're not a villain either. You know, you're a human being, and with all the complexity that involves and all the contradictions that involves. I love the openness of her story. We never really find out about the character.
No.
And, yeah, he's, it reads like a sort of as an antidote, I think.
Yeah, totally. And also, you know, there is the possibility that the aunt is totally aware of kind of what's happening and, you know, is letting it happen. I feel like, you know, an easier story, a worse writer would have made you feel sorry for her, or like giving you kind of sympathy for her. And instead, she's her own kind of very naughty, complex, sort of inaccessible character, which is...
it gives her that agency to be that. She's not a victim, not some one-dimensional trope that people seem to want to turn themselves into, or definitely turn others into more and more. And I don't recognize that. We have the God-given right to be screwed up, you know, and not entirely know what we're doing or why we're doing stuff. And that, you know, that's why the story, I guess, the realism of this story seemed real to me, because it's a Gordian knot, you know. It's sort of so complicated that it's like life. I don't know why. There are things in my life I don't know why I did them.
Yeah, of course.
And I'll be unpacking them for the rest of my life, probably. And it's, you know, why did I write that book? Why did I fall out with my dad? It's like, who knows? There's reasons I tell myself that are convenient, but, you know, they're suspicious by their convenience. And sometimes you have to dig a little deeper and you realize that it's much more tempestuous, much more in flux. It's much more contradictory. And those characters seem to me like living, breathing people.
Yeah, yeah.
And not, you know, silhouettes or cardboard cutouts. Mm-hmm. And the story, a great sign of a short story for me, although, you know, I love the short story, like the Borges, the little sort of perfectly formed little machine. But I love short stories where there was a story before the story.
Yeah.
The story afterwards, and you get the sense you've just spent a little bit of time and it's now still continuing somewhere.
I agree. I think they're my favorite. They're the perfect stories. Before we go, because you brought it up and we're hoping for it to come back in a big way, what's your favorite noir? Well, I like noir a lot. Noir film. No, not book.
I love, you know, I'm a sucker for Raymond Chandler and things like that, but I actually love The Night of the Hunter, which is a surreal kind of noir. I have a real fondness for that. The weird bit where they're going down the river and they're singing, the little kids singing a song. But I think
watched it last year or something, but yeah.
It's amazing. It's amazing. It's magical. Patricia Highsmith for me is like the queen of noir. I just love how, I wouldn't say nihilistic, misanthropic she is. Mm. I think that's just beautiful.
Yeah.
I think that she just has this worldview that's so, it's very different from the way I see the world, but I find it seductive. I just find it incredibly compelling. For me, she's the greatest.
Yeah, she is. Yeah. Well, maybe we're going to see in the next few years the return to war. Thank you so much, Darren. And thank you so much for picking that story, which I can...
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. Thank you to the Arts Council for the support, and we'll see you again soon.